It's my great pleasure this afternoon to introduce Professor Stewart. She's a renowned scholar specializing in Indigenous mental health, Indigenous research ethics and methods in health and post-secondary education. She's also the TC Energy Chair in Indigenous Health and Well-Being, Director of the Wakabinis and Bryce Institute for Indigenous Health, and an Associate Professor in the Division of Social and Behavioral Science at the University of Toronto. She's also a member of the Yellowknife Dene First Nation. And this afternoon, she's going to bring her insights to tell us about the experience of Indigenous peoples here in Canada. So, Dr. Stewart, take it away.
Thank you very much for having me here today. I'm really excited and appreciate this opportunity. And I'm going to share my screen. So as Dr. Myers said in his very kind and generous introduction, my name is Suzanne Stewart. I'm from the Yellowknife Dene First Nation in the Northwest Territories. And I live and work here in Toronto in Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe territory as a clinical psychologist and researcher at the University of Toronto, where I am the first permanent director of the Wakabinis Bryce Institute for Indigenous Health for about 4 years now. And for 10 years before that, I was a professor in clinical and counseling psychology, also at the University of Toronto. I want to talk a little bit, you know, give everyone a little bit of an overview of sort of what we're going to talk about today, and let you know that I'm really happy and excited to be here, and I'm grateful that all of you came to hear what I had to share with you, all of which is really based on community-driven research and work with Indigenous communities, both locally, provincially, nationally, and internationally. Rob tells me that we will have time for questions at the end. So if you have any questions, you can hold them till the end, and I'm happy to answer them. If you want to either just, unmute and ask when we get to that point, or if you'd rather just type them in the chat, that's fine too. Pretty easy going. Who are we here to talk about, and why are we doing this? Well, we're here to talk about Indigenous people in Canada. And I would say there is a fairly large lack of knowledge around who Indigenous people are, how many are in Canada, and where they live. So Indigenous, when you hear this word, this is a blanket general term that is referring to three distinct cultural identities, legally recognized identities in Canada. And that is the First Nations, who are status and non-status Indians, the Inuit or Inuk, who are the original people from the circumpolar region of Canada, and the Métis, who are a unique and specific cultural identity that was created from the intermarriage of the James Bay Cree Indians and the French fur traders. And they have their original land base in the Red River region of Manitoba. According to the latest census data of the federal government, there are over 2 million Indigenous people living in Canada. And in Ontario, we actually have the largest number of Indigenous people with 375,000. However, if you talk to people in Indigenous communities, you talk to leaders in urban and reserve settings, most people would say that this number is a gross underestimation for reasons that we're going to explain as we go through, and that there's probably at least double this number of Indigenous people. Where do you go in Canada if you want to meet or see an Indigenous person? Well, not necessarily to a remote or northern community, because more than half of our people, and by varying accounts, 60 to 75% of our people live in urban areas. And the largest number of Indigenous people in all of Canada is right here in the city of Toronto, where I am, with, again, by various accounts, anywhere from 75 to 150,000 Indigenous people currently reside. One thing that is well established in the data is that the Indigenous population in Canada is very young, with the largest and fastest growing youth demographic of any population within the country. So over half of our people are under the age of 24, and of those, more than half are under the age of 16. So what happens, what the issues are for our young people is very important right now. Anything to do with Indigenous people, whether it's health, environmental science, geography, education, you name it, is always going to be very context heavy. And the reason for that is because Indigenous people have lived and continue to live in a very strong colonial context. Indigenous people in Canada have historically experienced multiple colonial aggressions and assaults. And by that, I mean that education as a system was used as a tool of oppression through the creation of residential schools. The child welfare systems and the healthcare systems have also been part of a segregation that are also sites of intensive and invasive harms. And these harms have all been extremely personal in nature to every Indigenous person who lives in Canada. Education today, including post-secondary, continues to be a site of systemic and personal oppression for all Indigenous people. So some of you may be wondering, well, how did this happen and why did this happen? And I'm going to give you a really quick explanation of how and why this happened. So when Canada was created in the 1800s, meaning the federal infrastructure of the country, when the Federalists kind of came together, they realized that there was a bit of an issue with creating a new country because there were already millions of people living here before Europeans came here, and those were the Indigenous people. There were, and again, there's no real accounts, but there were in North America over 100 million Indigenous people living here, and in Canada, there was probably double or triple what there is right now. So there was a lot of people already living here with their their villages, their political infrastructures, their whole systems were in place. And so when the Europeans came here, they realized, okay, well, you know, we have a bit of a problem because we want to create a country here, but there's already a bunch of people living here. So we have to find a way to legally eradicate them. So they created a law that was called the Indian Act in 1876. The Indian Act is what allowed the country of Canada actually become incorporated and be created, because it was dealing with what the federal government called the Indian problem. That is, all of the people who were already inhabiting the land that they wanted to take over and use to create a new country for mass immigration of Europeans to come here and start to populate. So the Indian Act had to be created to remove Indigenous people so that the new Canadians could have unfettered access to land and natural resources to create their new country. So the Indian Act had many different parts to it, but the overall objective of the Indian Act was to eradicate Indigenous people either by death or through assimilation. So one of the very successful tactics of assimilation was part of the Indian Act legislation called the Residential School Act. And residential schools were created as part of that assimilation tactic to eradicate the population. And the primary objectives of residential school were to, by force, remove and isolate children from the influence of their families, homes, and community in order to assimilate them into the dominant culture. And this was viewed as very successful, and the federal government actually documented residential schools' success for the world to see. And in the Indian Act, the written objective of residential schools was to kill the Indian and the child. And that was based on the assumption that Indigenous cultural beliefs and spirituality were inferior or unequal to Euro-Canadian Christian ones. So my parents went to residential school, and this is actually my mom's picture that we got during the reconciliation process that Ottawa had from when she was in grade 9. And here's another picture of the success of residential schools. Until the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada was struck in 2006, there was actually no information at all about residential schools in Canada, as the federal government had either locked up and refused to distribute information or data or records, or much of it had been purposefully destroyed in order not to be accessed. What was recovered from federal archives and records within the Department of Indian Affairs, which is the federal branch of the government that administers the Indian Act, 150,000 children were documented as being in these schools from the 1870s till when the last one closed in 1996. Communities say that the number was much higher, but this is what the data shows. Also within the federal data, it showed that a minimum of 3,000 children were recorded as having died, and about 500 of those had recorded no identity. Disease was the major killer, so influenza, tuberculosis, smallpox, and that was second to malnutrition, drowning, exposure. And it was well documented that many children were victims of physical and sexual abuse, and many children died trying to run away or by suicide. So the post-secondary education systems in Canada have carried out the federal Indian Act by perpetuating historical and continued harms on Indigenous individuals and communities. And these include things such as harmful research on Indigenous individuals, communities, or lands, imposing Western healthcare policy and education practices on Indigenous individuals, communities, delegitimizing and ridiculing traditional knowledges, medicines, healers, and healing practices, and Indigenous pedagogies within systems of education, especially in universities. Historical and current institutional and personal racism and discrimination, and overly pathologizing Indigenous peoples, as well as supporting Western health education and professionalization that is not accessible or hospitable to Indigenous students. In 2008, our then Prime Minister made a public and official apology to Indigenous people. And within that apology, he did state that presently, it is unacceptable that we had this type of policy and that it actually harmed a lot of Indigenous people. So that was a big moment in Canadian history. Factors of colonization have influenced all aspects of health for many Indigenous communities and are linked to the high rates of mental health challenges and education and employment challenges. These traumas that Indigenous people have experienced as a result of colonialism, which includes residential school, are really rooted in attempts in cultural extermination and the creation of deep set pains for our people in regard to identity. Healing and health promotion from these harms can really begin through the reconnection and the relationship with current Indigenous traditional knowledges. So some of you may have heard the term intergenerational trauma, and that is now well established in the literature and the data as a legacy of residential school. And intergenerational trauma is passed on through generations and is conducted through family and community relationships and experience. So some concrete examples of intergenerational trauma can be seen in educational attainment and achievement, parenting, employment outcomes, interpersonal and family relationships, health and health outcomes and mental health. And I'm sure that many of you can think of many other examples of how, of what intergenerational trauma looks like. So that's sort of the history of where Indigenous people have come from. And you know, that's just kind of a really small snapshot of what it looked like and what the Indian Act, how it impacted Indigenous people. But in fact, the Indian Act was really something that, you know, through its genocidal policies that include assimilation projects like residential school, had many, many other. There were about 200 policies within the Indigenous or within the Indian Act, but the residential school policy is one that had the most impact on Indigenous people, because what it effectively did is it created that trauma in every Indigenous individual, and whether they were a child, whether they were a parent, whether they were an auntie, whether they were an uncle, whether they were a grandparent, whether they were a sibling, in every Indigenous person who is currently living or has lived in any of the last, you know, four generations. So there's no Indigenous person that you're going to meet in Canada today who doesn't have direct or indirect impacts of residential school. And so in other words, this isn't something that happened 500 years ago. This is something that happened, you know, I'm the oldest of seven children. My younger siblings went to residential school. And I only didn't go because my grandparents, who all their kids went to residential school, when they had me, they were taking care of me. They didn't want me to get taken by the RCMP and the Indian agent. So they sent me to live with a non-native white relative in the city so that I wouldn't be taken and put into school. But instead, of course, I ended up, you know, in foster care and having a lot of other things happen to me, which is another part of the Indian Act, is there were systemic policies that were put in place through social service and child welfare. And some of you may have heard of that as well. And that's known as the 60s scoop, although it started much earlier than that, like in the 1920s, where Indigenous babies and children were taken away from Indigenous families just because they were Indians, not for any other child protection reason. That was written into the law of the Indian Act. So there were many multiple layers to the way that the Indian Act harmed Indigenous people, but residential school, the 60s scoop, forced land relocation, that is the segregation of onto Indian reserves, where until, you know, as late as in some cases, the 60s, 70s and 80s, Indigenous people were not allowed to leave reserves. So that's, oh, hang on a second, my daughter. Scarlett, yeah, goodbye. Sorry. Give me a hug. Just give me a quick hug. Bye, I love
you. Okay, I'll see you soon.
Okay. So, you know, that's where we come from. That's what the context is of every Indigenous person's life in Canada. What we're dealing with right now, this deep wound, this deep personal wound that we have from being torn away from our families, being forced not to be Native, being told that Native is bad, being forced to be Christians, being taken away from our culture, identity, and language. The Indian Act had all kinds of policies that made everything about being an Indigenous person against the law, from speaking your language, to living in your community, to being with your family, to practicing your culture, your language, all those things. And quite often people come up to me, especially people who have worked to sort of reclaim cultures and languages from other places in the world where they have been success with that. And they say, you know, why haven't you guys been able to get your language back? You know, we worked in this country or in that country, and we were able to, you know, get our language back after the war or do this or that. And, you know, everyone's supportive of that. And I think the big difference is that people in Canada don't understand, because this history of oppression has really been hidden from the world, and even from us, is that we, other cultures in Canada, have laws to protect their language, their practices, their spirituality, their religion. We have had and still today have laws that make our culture and our language and our practices illegal. So we really have what truly is that systemic oppression that happens to all, has happened and continues to happen. And when we talk about that today, researchers and educators have shown that using a Western paradigm, meaning non-Indigenous ways of being and doing in education, in healthcare, those are primarily the fields that I work in with Indigenous people, is actually a form of continued colonial oppression, and that this perpetuates the original trauma of residential school. For example, we're talking about education. So, you know, we have this wound from residential school experiences, and then we get out into, you know, Canadian society, and we have to go to college, we have to go to university, where these cultural oppressive practices continue to happen, and they just keep that wound going, that original wound. And it just gets perpetuated through all of the systems and through all of the generations. So this was first, what I'm talking about, this continued oppression of Indigenous people through the academic realm has been documented. And it really wasn't until 1999, for the first time addressed in the academic literature by an Indigenous academic from New Zealand, Maori, Linda Tway-Smith. She wrote the first book that was published that documented the harms of research and education on Indigenous people. And that was called Decolonizing Methodologies. And that's still considered the seminal work on the harms of colonialism on Indigenous people through the academic world. Since that time in Canada, we've grown some wonderful scholars who have addressed this systematically through the research. Marlene Brandt Castanello at the University of Queens and Marie Batiste at the University of Saskatchewan. They've written extensively on how education has harmed and continues to harm Indigenous people and what some of the solutions to those are. I think it's very important to understand that today, Indigenous people, while we might not be in residential school anymore, we continue to live under colonial oppression. And, you know, when we're talking about what goes on in post-secondary institutions, education and research really needs to be reconceptualized and practiced differently to emphasize empowerment rather than oppression. So, for example, 5% of researchers, that is researchers who are doing research on or with Indigenous peoples or communities, have specialized training in cross-cultural methodologies. And less than 0.5% of these researchers doing Indigenous research have any knowledge of an Indigenous language or worldview. Research with Indigenous people is often nothing more than cultural tourism to benefit the tourists, meaning the researchers and their audience. And Indigenous communities today continue to lack control of academic research processes and results, because there's no unified policy guideline or methodology in Canada to regulate this. You may recall that I earlier mentioned that about 70% of our people live in urban areas. Well, when it comes to academic functioning, it's very unclear to universities who Indigenous groups and appropriate authorities are off of reserve. And big data continues to be a challenge for Indigenous populations, especially in health and education research. And I hinted at that kind of at the beginning when we were simply just trying to say, you know, who are Indigenous people, how many are here, and where do they live? So anything to do with significance and data is going to be very tricky with Indigenous people because of this history and current context of colonization and harm. Indigenous people are not going to come forward and identify in a census or participate in research because research has caused so much harm to people. Research on strengths and solutions, even today, continues to lack with Indigenous people. And there's a lack of capacity for Indigenous research in both academic and community settings. And universities, despite valiant efforts over the last, you know, 5 years, I would say, are not hospitable or safe places for Indigenous people to work, learn, or be. There has been an effort to address this by Indigenous communities, and this was first done in 2007 when NAHO, the National Aboriginal Health Organization, which Harper pulled the plug on in 2015, published what it called the OCAP principles. And this was ownership, control, access, and possession, or self-determination, as it was applied to research. This was the first document that was published or existed in Canada to address these systemic harms that exist in research and in universities on Indigenous people. In 2009, the Tri-Council published what it called Chapter 9, the ethical conduct for research involving Indigenous people. That was revised in 2014. Until 2009, this wasn't addressed by the Tri-Council, and many of the issues that were brought up by the Tri-Council were those that were articulated in the OCAP principles. So at the federal level, those are really the only two sort of guiding documents that exist, but they are recommendations. There's nothing required about any of those. When we look a little deeper at sort of what does all this mean sort of for education and intergenerational trauma, well, there's a lot of very concerning stats about the low educational attainment and achievement of Indigenous people in Canada. The federal government still has only data published from the National Household Survey that was published in 2006. And so it looks like I have only old data, but in fact, there is no newer federal data at this point. But we do know that at a national level, this is what the picture looks like, you know, that around half our people don't have a high school. Hang on, sorry. What, Scarlett?
Have you seen my jacket? I'm looking for it. I'm waiting.
I don't know where your jacket is, dear.
My Carhartt one.
Yeah, I saw your friend wearing it yesterday when we went out. Yeah. Sorry. I have teenagers in the house. You know how that is. I mean, I've been like in Australia and had someone call me from home and say, do you know where my hairbrush is? I mean, you know, at least they're talking to me, right? where was I? Okay, so, you know, the stats basically show that there are a lot of problems with graduating from high school, especially on reserves. And, you know, we know that in Canada, there's a very strong understanding that without a high school diploma, it's going to be very difficult for young people to go on and have any satisfaction in career development and not really live above the poverty line. What's really important to understand about education is that Indigenous education is really not about learning, it's about a process of healing. All Indigenous people have been through this residential school trauma, either directly or indirectly. And that's a deep kind of open wound that we're all dealing with right now. And even our children, like my kids and my siblings' kids, you know, they have to deal with a group of adults, their parents and their grandparents, who are deeply wounded by these experiences. So that may make it a little bit more understanding as to why it looks like Indigenous people may not always support education or think it's a good thing. Of course, we think it's a good thing. Of course, we support education. But going into a Western institutional environment may not be the right way to enact positive and life-affirming education for Indigenous people because of this history of trauma with education. So that challenge that I was talking about, Indigenous people being in an education crisis, has been extremely well documented by the government. And these are some of the stats that I pulled from Stats Canada to sort of show us the difference between Indigenous and non-Indigenous and post-secondary certification. So, you know, we see that Indigenous people really don't have the type of university education that other people have, but do have in terms of the trades or colleges. That also the proportion of population attending any level of school by Indigenous people is going to be lower than for non-Indigenous people. And that the proportion of youth with any post-secondary certification by identity is also much lower. So, you know, some of the challenges that the post-secondary system poses to Indigenous people are, you know, access. You know, Indigenous people might not be able to get into university because their grades don't exist the way that they need to make them be competitive. Or they may not be able to go to school because of the financial access or the geographical access. Or maybe, you know, they just don't have the infrastructure in their lives to be able to access school the way non-Indigenous people have because of the context of colonization. Indigenous people also are well documented as experiencing high levels of racism and discrimination within universities. There are only non-Indigenous educational practices at most universities. And there's a need for Indigenous healing, spirituality, and medicines in universities that just don't exist in enough of a widespread way. There's also a lack of control of education processes by students and by Indigenous communities. So, you know, where are we kind of like, where are we supposed to go from here? Well, you know, starting in 2015 with the publication of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada's final report on the impacts of residential school on Indigenous people, we have been thrust into what I think Canada likes to call the era of reconciliation. And reconciliation is really for non-Indigenous people and not for the Indigenous people. So that's for Canada as a country and all of the people who are not Indigenous to come to terms with what that means to reconcile these harms that were done to Indigenous people and continue to be done in order for every non-Indigenous person in Canada to have a home, have a place to live, have a school, have a bank, have a road, have electricity, have water, have the internet, have coffee, have televisions. Everything that non-native people have here is done on the harms of the direct bodies of Indigenous people through the legislation and the enactment of the Indian Act and all of its policies. So that's one piece of where we're supposed to be going in Canada. The second piece is really sort of more where my work is, and that is around looking at things from an Indigenous perspective. And in our work that we do at the University of Toronto, we call those Indigenous determinants of health and education. So that report, which we call the TRC report for short, and if you don't know about it, you can go look it up. I mean, I could spend a whole hour just explaining what that is, but you can look it up, TRC Report Canada, and there's a whole interactive website that the government has made to help people understand what this is. And this was published in 2015 after 6 years of research to address the current and historical impacts of the residential school system on the lives and the lives of individuals and communities, and basically to restore relations between Indigenous peoples and everyone else who's living here, including the systems of government. And, you know, this report, which is like 300 pages, there's a summary of it, so you don't have to read the whole report, ended with saying that, you know, the residential school experience impacted all of Indigenous people through four systems that run the country. And that is through the child welfare system, through the education system, through the health system, and through the justice system. This is where the most harms are to our people. And I've circled education there because that's the part that we're going to talk about. But there is a lot of depth and detail to each of these other systems in Canada. And you may be thinking, wow, that's really nice that the federal government decided to strike up a TRC commission in 2006 and spend millions of dollars, because it cost millions of dollars to write this report. They had to hire a chair that was Justice Murray Sinclair, the first Indigenous judge in Canada, who was the head of the TRC commission. You know, it took years to do this and cost millions and millions of dollars. And that was nice of them, but actually they didn't do it because they were nice or because they thought, yeah, we harmed all these people and it was really bad. They did it because the United Nations had charged Canada with some severe and gross acts of human rights violations through the residential school system. And so the federal government was actually forced to do this in response to those international charges of human rights violations in the international court. So the federal government was actually quite unwilling to engage in this process. And when the TRC commission actually asked the federal government to hand over all the records of the residential schools, the federal government itself, and that was the Department of, it's called something else now, but it used to be called the Department of Indian and Northern Affairs. I think Trudeau calls it Indigenous Relations now. That's the part of the federal government that's tasked with managing and rolling out the Indian Act. They actually refused to give over the records of anything to do with residential schools for this commission, which was also part of the federal government. So the TRC actually had to sue the branch of federal Indian Affairs in Supreme Court in order to get them to release the records of residential schools for this investigation. So, you know, this hasn't been an easy process. The TRC report was made kind of a big splash at the time, and that put the word reconciliation on the lips of, I would say, probably at least 50% of Canadians. And that's a good thing. It's created some systemic changes. And I can say that you know, the issues that are raised in this report are not going to go away or disappear, but the report probably will. And this has been a great report to begin national and international discussions on solutions. And, you know, people are always asking me and other sort of Native people, you know, what is it that you want from us? You know, what do Natives want from Canada, from non-Native people? And that's really based, that question I think is really based on sort of gross misinformation and ignorance, like true ignorance about who Indigenous people are and what the history of Canada and Indigenous people are, because most Canadians seem to think that Indigenous people have more things and more rights than non-Indigenous people do, which is the complete opposite of the reality of the situation. And what we're asking for really is laid out in 94 concrete recommendations in this report. And it's up to all Canadian people to take action with these recommendations, because without all of these harms to us in these four systems, including education, Canada would not exist in any way, and no non-Native person would have any of the benefits that they have as citizens or as individuals living in this country. So, you know, that's Canada's responsibility to take actions to stop continuing to perpetuate these harms against Indigenous people in these four systems. And it's our responsibility as Native people to take action for our own healing. Every Native person is deeply harmed by these things that have happened. Even me, everyone, all of us, me, my children, my parents, my grandparents. Well, my grandparents are gone now. But I mean, you know, these are things, we're wounded and we're hurt. And if my arm was broken or my skull was cracked open, I was bleeding, I would have to go and get help to heal that because it'd be on the outside. But a lot of us carry the wounds on the inside, and those are harder to heal because I'm a very functional person, but I'm just as damaged and broken down from all of this as the street person that you see who's lost their kids, who's doing drugs, who's drinking, and who's sleeping in the park. That's me on the inside, but on the outside, I'm a functional person because for some reason I've been given the gift to be able to function with these wounds inside me, to do this work that I have to do. And I still have to heal those wounds that I have because I have to be a good parent. I have to be a good partner. I have to, you know, contribute to society and help do what my meaning and purpose is to do. That's my responsibility, healing my wounds. So my question to everybody here really is, why is Indigenous reconciliation important in academic environments? You know, whether it's in research, whether it's in teaching, you know, why is it important? So this is where people can speak or say something or have a comment, or it would be great. I'm sure you're sick of hearing my voice, and I'm actually getting a little parched. So please, I'd love to hear from people.
Oh, okay, I could say something. I mean, I think one of the reasons this is so important is because, you know, all we know is colonial education. That's all any of us know. And we've all lost something in terms of the fact that all the bits of culture and the things that have used in Indigenous pedagogy, like you said, those were all taken away, and they were taken away from everybody. And so there are tremendous advantages out there that we don't know even exist. And so we can start incorporating those into our education and make it less colonial and more encompassing of, you know, different belief systems.
That was really beautiful. Thank you.
And you know, one of the things, and this is kind of ties into recent news, you know, one of my sons goes to Laurentian University. And one of the things I loved about Laurentian is that they have to take Indigenous courses. They have to take Indigenous language, Indigenous culture courses as a way of, you know, kind of learning things that are almost lost. And now, you know, now we're seeing that that's being taken away. So one of the few instances where non-Indigenous people are really required to get that learning is disappearing.
Yeah, that's a difficult one. It's a very difficult one. I mean, that would seem obvious that all post-secondary schools should have a mandatory course on, you know, Indigenous history of Canada, or, well, really, it's just the history of Canada. Anyone else? I see lots of like awesome smiling people, and I'd love to hear from you. And I'm actually really shy, so I'd really love to hear from someone else.
I'll jump in. I think one of the things that we want to pride ourselves on is diversity of thought, having all the brightest minds working together on the hardest problems. And if we're going to solve the problems for all of humanity, we have to have that those diverse points of view. I think some of the challenges is to be sensitive enough to understand how to draw these things out of each other, how to create a safe place for knowledge exchange. But it's critical.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think everyone shares that, you know, the sentiment that you have, but I think it's a good starting place for sure.
Do you have suggestions on how we can get there? What the pathway might look like?
Well, I mean, a lot of systemic change has to happen. And because universities, well, and actually all of Canadian society is Western hierarchical, patriarchal, colonial structures, it has to come from the top down, that type of change, because the top is who's in charge right now. I mean, to make those changes, you know, leadership has to really support these types of changes. Because I've been in the institution where I had really no voice and no say, and really no change happens unless the leadership is supporting that change. Anyone else? I still have more in my presentation, so I want to give
people... I think Rob Mann wanted to say something. Why don't you go ahead, Rob?
Yeah, okay. This is very interesting. I think in terms of your question, I think the biggest struggle post-secondary people in the sciences have is what this looks like, particularly with physics. What would it mean to incorporate the kinds of things you're saying into the teaching of physics and into the research of physics? And that may be partly because of what Jamie said, but it is also, I think, probably due to a notion that physics is the least human, if I dare say it, of all the sciences. It's supposed to be the most observer independent description of nature possible, culturally independent, psychologically independent. And maybe we're all wrong about that, but I think to go to the specifics of what I assume are most of the audience listening, I'd say, at least for me, that's the biggest struggle. I honestly don't know what it means to do this in the context of what we research and what we teach. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So let me just make sure I understand what you're saying. And that is, you're not sure what it would mean to decolonize and indigenize physics.
Yeah. That's correct. I really don't know. I'm saying that very genuinely. I honestly don't know what that would
I barely mean. Know what physics are from a Western perspective. So, but I do understand how university program and curriculum works. But I would like some people here who are in physics, and I'll bet some people have some great answers to that. Because to me, it would be really simple to answer that. But I would rather someone who is like who is a physicist could answer that better probably in a way that might make more sense to you.
I could try to say something maybe. You know, I think at the basic level, like, you know, a lot of people in like the physical sciences, they kind of pride themselves on a sense of like objectivity, but really underlying everything we do, there's a kind of, you know, formerly Christian, now allegedly atheist, sort of Western philosophy ontology in our whole approach to kind of academia and the way we teach everything, including physics. You know, at the fundamental level, like, none of us really know what all these forces are or what's going on. Like, you can take some very operational view, and all we have is, you know, the outputs of some experiments and our guesses about them. And like, in teaching students, there's no reason to preference this kind of like European centric, basically like ontology of the universe.
That's an excellent answer. That's probably a more detailed answer that I would give. That's great.
Anyone else? Did you want to say?
Yeah, go ahead. And if someone could tell me how much time we have left.
We have about 10 minutes. Do you want to continue with the discussion?
No, I like the discussion.
Okay. Okay.
That's really helpful.
Finian, what did you want to say something? I think you're.
I think your mic's not working, Finian.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. So I have a concrete example involving some Indigenous people in research in particular. So I'm from New Zealand, which you mentioned a researcher from. So at my old university, there was a researcher called Gillian Turner, and part of her research was involving understanding the changing of the Earth's magnetic field. And as it turned out, the Indigenous people of New Zealand use these, basically an oven constructed in the earth using hot stones. And the stones were heated to such a level that you could see the change in the temperature. They would go through a transition called the Curie temperature. And so you could actually track potentially the changing of the earth's magnetic field in these stones, sort of relating archaeology and physics. And so I know she went out and talked to Indigenous people and got involved with their communities and sort of actively went out and searched and tried to involve herself in the discussion and get them involved too. So I think there are ways of doing that. You just have to be creative.
Yeah, I have heard of other stuff like that too. So I think there are a lot of ways that can happen. And actually, I'm going to go back to the presentation just for a minute, and then we'll come back to the two people who have their hands up, just so we can make sure that we get through it and respect people's time. Can everyone see that? Oh, we gotta go this like this. You can still see that, right?
Yep.
So there are actually a number of texts that have been written to answer the kind of question actually that was just posed, you know, how do we do this in multiple disciplines, such as mathematics, secondary and post-secondary education. And these are all books that really help people to understand what the procedure of this looks like. I'm just sharing some of the examples of these, what that looks like. And, you know, so as we kind of start to conclude, I know I put a lot of information at people, but I think it's really important for people to understand that this legacy of colonization has created what public health calls you know, the social determinants of health for Indigenous people. And public health would hold that because of the Indian Act, Indigenous people have the poorest health and of any population group in Canada. However, you know, we don't actually fully see it that way from an Indigenous knowledge's perspective, because we have what we call Indigenous determinants of wellness based in our paradigm. And those are things such as, you know, elders and traditional knowledge, our language, being on the land, having our traditional food, engaging in ceremony, having love and relationships in our lives, and doing this as we recover from colonial trauma. So when these things are present in our life, we are well, as opposed to certain things not being present in our life, causing us to be ill, which is kind of two ways of looking at one particular phenomenon. And this is sort of trying to express what it would be like to look at anything from an Indigenous lens and to understand how completely different it is, but yet what the similarities are at the same time. So some of the recommendations really from the research that we've been doing over the last 15 years at U of T are, you know, how are we gonna create student success? And I'm talking about, let's just say in physics, for example, well, creating scholarships and bursary programs for Indigenous students, creating Indigenous mentoring programs for Indigenous students, having elders and knowledge keepers as part of the curriculum, not as social supports off to the side. I mean, having elders co-teaching courses with faculty. That's what we do in our program. Having Indigenous ceremony on campus, creating tuition that works for Indigenous people, having legal services for Indigenous students, and having Indigenous practicum options, as well as, and I can't say how important this is, cultural safety training for staff and faculty. These things would address the challenges that Indigenous students face, as well as developing an Indigenous quality assurance framework and Indigenous evaluation frameworks, formalized campus and Indigenous community partnerships that are based on Indigenous values, protocols, and principles, and really creating relationships that foster cultural and spiritual practices that allow for the creation of best practice models. So, I mean, if you were to develop that in physics, I think that would just be really, really, that'd be innovative. You'd have so many Native students there so quickly. It would be really amazing. And I just want everyone to know really that, you know, racism and negative stereotypes are still the major challenge for Indigenous people in all aspects of life, including health, including education. And, you know, the influence of our families and our communities and our backgrounds is really what creates pride and strength and success for young people in our communities. And we really need to increase the efficacy of this in post-secondary situations. That piece about culture, through ceremony, through language, through community is really what my research over the last 10 years has really shown that creates academic success for students. See that little girl in there? That was the one who just came in. She's like 6 feet tall and 16, but she used to be cute and small. Well, she's still cute, I guess, but you know, how cute is a 16-year-old? So, I mean, basically, what do we need to do? We need to create a holistic approach to education and healing that is based in the holistic model of the Indigenous holistic model, which emphasizes the mental, the physical, the spiritual, and the emotional, but especially the spiritual, because that's the piece that has really been made against the law, that we weren't allowed to practice, and that is the foundation of all of our knowledge and being. So to really decolonize and indigenize physics would mean to bring spirit into physics. Now, probably some people understand that, and maybe some people don't, and maybe some people don't want to, or maybe some people are interested. In reality, it's my opinion, based on my own experience and the research that's been done, that this is the only way that things are going to truly reconcile for Indigenous people, is if an approach like this is taken. So I don't have any more to share, but I would still like to welcome the questions. And there's my contact information if you want to reach out to me. And those are some of the strong, you know, Anishinaabe Kwe that I work with in our lab.
Okay, thank you very much. Everybody can show their appreciation. You know, this is always in these Zoom meetings. This is the anticlimactic part of the talk. The tradition is that we first ask for questions from students. So are there any students who would like to ask a question? Nikta?
Hello.
There you go.
Thanks, Rob. So thanks for the talk. And I really appreciated the part about the awareness about the residential schools, because I came across it through very few people knowing about it. I just wanted to add something that I came across that is in the section of racism that Indigenous people face. If I'm saying anything wrong, please correct me, Suzanne. So I came across this, which says, for several decades, the early 1940s till the early 1980s, Inuk communities in Canada's north were forced to wear dog tags because colonizers could not be bothered to learn their names. By 1945, the Family Allowance Act of Canada defined an quote unquote Eskimo as one to whom an identification disc has been issued. And as I understand now, it's understood as a racial slur that we should not be using. And just to add to that, it was only later that an Inuk member decided to reclaim their names instead of being referred to as a number. So yeah, I just wanted to share this information and be corrected if it's not correct. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that. So that's one of the policies of the Indian Act that was enforced by law. And we still all have numbers. We just don't have to wear them around our necks anymore. We have to have them on a card that we carry around, because Indigenous people aren't like non-Indigenous people. We're all wards of the crown still today. So that continues. So thank you for sharing that.
I'm going to turn to Lay, because I know she had her hand up before. So Lay, did you want to ask a question?
Yes. Thank you so much for your talk, Suzanne. I really learned a lot. I just wanted to go back to Rob Mann's question regarding like how physics may be biased. And I just want to give a specific example of how I think it could be biased. And the example is basically when you give presentations at other universities or at this university or at Perimeter, it is still often accepted to be quite aggressive with your questioning of basically someone's research. And to the point of where, you know, of course questions are encouraged and they should be asked, but to the point of where it actually is quite detrimental and maybe too intense, you know, if it's about a detail, for example. And I think that this sort of questioning system is based in how, you know, people used to do it 10 years ago. And we're trying to move away from it. But for example, it has for sure negatively impacted women in science who are generally encouraged by society to be less confident in themselves, for example. And I think undoubtedly also impacts how, you know, how Indigenous researchers feel, how people of color feel. And so I think that that's one concrete thing that we can change about how we do physics. And the other thing I wanted to add is that I think that racism, like stereotypes of Indigenous people, as you said, is very much alive, and it's very much alive here at Perimeter. Like, I have heard negative stereotypes, and yeah, it's something we really need to work on. Yeah.
Miigwech, thank you.
I'll ask, iPad Eve, do you have a question?
Yes, sorry, I haven't figured out how to change my name on the settings. My name's Everett, so yeah, I'm a student at Waterloo. And so the first thing I wanted to mention was on Rob Mann's point about what can we do. And I think an intermediate step, while not fully addressing indigenization, but I think math and physics, which are my background, are very white male dominated fields. And I myself am a white male. And I think every effort, every opportunity that we have to include a different narrative, whether it's somebody from a different culture or women in physics and math. And in particular, I know that Perimeter has a lot of posters that have been around and that I see on Facebook with really accomplished women in theoretical physics. And I think displaying those narratives and putting a spotlight on them is a really important first step. And hopefully we'll be able to do that and expand beyond just the beyond like women in physics and get other cultures and hopefully Indigenous cultures and be able to tell those stories. I did have a question for Susan, and that was, I wonder what would be like the one biggest impact policy change that post-secondary education institutions could implement to really promote indigenization and decolonization of their institutions? Like, is there something that there has been research done about and people know we need to do this and people just haven't done it? And if so, what is it? Or is it something that we need to look into more? Do we need to do more research and try to determine what are like the three first steps we need to do to decolonize and indigenize our PSC systems in Canada?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there's multiple things, but you have to remember that Indigenous people right now, so we're not really part, I mean, okay, this is my opinion, and I think a lot of Indigenous, I've heard other Indigenous leaders say this, but so I'm not speaking for all Indigenous people, I'm speaking for my understanding of things. Indigenous people aren't looking for social justice and that sort of thing. And we often get put together with other quote unquote minority, meaning not part of the dominant society identity, populations. And of course I agree that we're always gonna be stronger together against kind of the man, like the white man as a system. However, Indigenous people have a completely different objective than other minority groups in Canada. And that is, we're seeking sovereignty. We don't have the same human rights that non-Indigenous Canadians have. We're looking for basic autonomy and self-determination over our own existence. So if there's a way that sovereignty could exist within post-secondary education for Indigenous people, then that would be great. So I'll give you a concrete example. So I was just awarded an honorary doctorate from a university, and the ceremony's next week. And I had to meet with some people from there, and they want me to wear a gown and a hood. And I said, well, I don't want to do that because I think it's colonial and patriarchal, and I would never wear a gown or a hood or go to a ceremony because I've never gone to any of my own convocation ceremonies because I won't participate in those ceremonies. So I've had my diplomas mailed to me because when I graduated, they didn't have any other option. And they're like, oh, well, we've heard that, you know, like, what would you rather do? Because they're being nice to me because I think I'm the first Native person they've ever given an honorary doctorate to at this university. I'm not going to say who it is because it's not public yet. And I said, well, I've heard of some Native people wearing regalia at the convocation. I'd feel more comfortable doing that, you know, if I'm going to go to a ceremony. And they were like, okay, well, you know, we can do that. Like, it's a big deal, but they're going to let me do that. And then they say, okay, but we're still going to have to mail you the hood and someone's going to have to put that on for you. And I'm like, I'm not wearing your hood. I'm just not doing that. And so I think that's like an example of a lack of sovereignty of who I am as an Indigenous person within an education system. So something as simple as that, meaning that I have to conform and assimilate to European Western practices in order to coexist and do the same things as my non-Indigenous counterparts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that was actually a really good example. I appreciate that. Thank you.
For the next question, I'm going to turn to Gazelle. Would you like to ask a question?
Yes, sure. Yeah, I just wanted to make one comment regarding, again, Rob's question about objectivity and in physics and following up the narrative. And I wanted to say, yes, physics could be very objective, but we have to remember that physicists couldn't be further from objectivity because especially theoretical physics is a field of ideas, and ideas are heard the louder your voice is. And even in overall, like even in experimental or observational, this can be very relevant. And one concrete example that comes to my mind is the controversy around 30-meter telescope in Hawaii, where it sounds like the scientists didn't take into account the perspective of the indigenous people on the land. And so therefore it is very relevant to physicists to know about this. Thank you.
I just want to respond to that. I can't say your last name, Dr. Can you say it? And just to say thank you for bringing that up. And you're in the Northwest Territories, right?
No, I am in Ontario.
Waterloo. Oh, you're in Ontario. I thought you were the person. But anyways, that was a great point. And you don't know how many people have brought up the telescope to me and asked me to get involved and do something about it, even though I have absolutely no real say in it. But because the University of Toronto has a researcher involved in it, I've been asked by Indigenous groups to get involved and, you know, get us out of there because we really aren't supposed to be there doing that sort of thing. So thank you.
Okay, as a last question, I'm going to turn to Gang. Would you like to ask a question? Gang?
Yep. Hello. So there is a master program at the perimeter, and we admit physics students. And I think the question I want to ask is that how do we admit indigenous people? Because they are educated a different way, and we probably need a different admission system. So you mentioned them, like there's not the Western grade system. Like we want to involve them in our program. So I think we need a good system to actually be inviting them in.
Well, I mean, you know, there's lots of Indigenous students who are very competitive and have extremely high grades and would be able to come there. I just think that, I mean, I don't know, but it would seem like many Indigenous students wouldn't feel like they belonged in that environment, just like they don't feel like they belong in psychology or public health or medicine, unless there's an Indigenous program where there's other people like them there. So creating an Indigenous program would be really important, or an Indigenous stream, or Indigenous supports, or anything like that would be the way to recruit Indigenous students and to have Indigenous faculty.
Okay, well, we've been taking questions, or Dr. Stewart's been taking questions for about 15 minutes. I think I'm gonna call a close to it. But I'll on behalf of everybody, I'll thank you again for a very insightful talk. And I guess we can all show our appreciation with the reactions or showing applause. But thank you, Dr. Stewart. That was terrific. Thank you.
Thank you.